Welcome back to Canna Week, brought to you by New Frontier Data, where you deliver the week's top headlines in cannabis and hear experts weigh in on the impacts these stories are having on the industry. I'm your host, Heather Wickline. All right, before we get started, if you are loving this podcast, please be sure to like, subscribe, leave a five-star review, share it, all that. So today we're going to be talking about the much anticipated East Coast markets coming online and what that means for the industry. So I'm really excited to get the perspective of someone who focuses on emerging vice markets. He is a venture capital expert and currently serves as chief investment officer at Clintel Capital. Please welcome Rick Battenberg III.
Clientel.
Sorry.
You know what? It's a dumb name. But you know what? We have to stick with it because we've been doing this long enough that we've done enough media. But you know, our intention was, you know, we're here for, you know, we're Clientel, right? We're here.
I like it.
Right.
Don't change it. I have to change.
Thank you for having me on. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it, and hopefully, I'm able to provide some insight into, you know, what we're doing and how we're doing it.
Awesome. And as always, I'm pleased to welcome back the Chief Knowledge Officer of New Frontier Data. Please welcome John Caggia. Welcome back.
Delighted to be back, Heather. Thank you for having me.
All right, Rick. I have one burning question for you because my son is a third. Are you going to carry it on?
Okay.
Hopefully have a son and make him the fourth, because it's a very, very, very hot topic.
All right. Well, if you want the real answer. So my family since 1305, the first son alternated Michael, John, Richard, Michael. Okay. So my grandfather named my father after himself, which was he was not supposed to do. So it was my great grandfather's dying wish, literally not figuratively, that the naming nomenclature would continue and be corrected. So I'm the anomaly, I guess, is the point. So my son is supposed to be named Michael John if I do indeed decide to have children. So
very good. I know. I think it's a lot of pressure. My sister had a son and she had him. She went with, you know, Lawrence Wiley V because they just didn't want to be the ones to break it.
A lot of generational pressure on me, actually. So my great-great-grandfather invented four-wheel drive and was a really cool guy. He was a really amazing human being, actually. Lots of patents and sold products all over the world. It's actually so cool. Actually, sitting right next to me at my desk is these are all the letters he got from over 100 years ago from GM and Ford, telling him that they don't think four-wheel drive is a viable consumable product. Rejection letters from Goodyear, from Acme Motor Company. This is from General Motors Company, signed by the president of GM 100 years ago to my grandfather, saying we don't think four-wheel drive is
it's not a winner. But
yeah,
which they were wrong. It always
reminds me to make sure that, you know, when you're right, sometimes you're just early, which in cannabis is super apt, because you know, we were definitely early, and so we started here in 2015.
What made you go into cannabis? You started your career at Merrill Lynch as a financial advisor?
Yeah. So I started at Merrill. You know, I was working on the syndicate team, the IPOs, the new issues, doing private equity, really the kind of weird stuff at Merrill, you know, the new issues. And so I really got a good understanding of what it takes to, you know, bring a new company to market. In 2015, I was in Colorado. I happen to have a background in capital finance. My family obviously has been doing business a long, long time. So, you know, I grew up reading a P&L, you know, in the basement, you know, at 4 years old. And what I saw was a capital inefficiency in cannabis. It was like, okay, we had to be a two-year Colorado resident to own a cannabis company. And so there was no precedence for the fund that I created at the time. So we became the first qualified institutional investment fund in the United States to own a license inside of a venture fund. And that was because there was no license. It didn't exist, right? So the fund structure that I had pontificated was, okay, well, if I have a bunch of people that have no say over the assets and we have a licensed holder, that is a two-year Colorado resident at the top of the fund, that the MED, Marijuana Enforcement Division of Colorado, would allow me to have this structure. And one of my mentors and an awesome human being, Heather Potters, you know, Ernst & Young's person of the year twice. She's CEO of a company called PharmaJet now. In 45 minutes, I've been working through this for like, I don't even know, probably 3 months trying to figure out the structure it needed to be. And in 45 minutes in Wheat Ridge and on a whiteboard in between her meetings, she's like, oh yeah, do it this way. Here you go. And that's what actually became the fund, which set the stage for where we are today. And what that means is that I really entered cannabis knowing I wanted to be in cannabis, but I knew that there was going to be a lot of regulatory shifts and changes that were going to come. So I needed the most flexible funding instrument possible to navigate those changes and be nimble, right? So from 2015 to 2017, I bought everything in the supply chain. So we grow, extraction, dispensary, ancillary packaging, hardware, compliance, training, everything. And the reason for that was because we needed to get our hands dirty. We needed to understand the supply chain. I've grown weed, I have extracted, I have filled packages, dispensary, all of it. And the reason is so that you really understand your supply chain. You need to understand how that product gets to market, how, you know, from soup to nuts, all the way to the end. And then in 2017, we're like, okay, I think we understand the supply chain. And we started to go, okay, well, I believe that we don't necessarily want to own the farms that are growing the grain that make the Grey Goose. And we don't necessarily want to own the liquor stores that only have geographic loyalty. You really want to own the brand, right? You want to own the brand because that's what has the most ability to proliferate. And so we began looking for brands. We began looking for something that had the widest appeal to the most people. And we found The Clear, which was a brand that was started in 2013. It was actually the first distillate brand that was ever created by Chris Barone. And it became very famous in the California medical market simply because it was so good. You know, it was such a great brand. And we went, okay, this is the brand that we can reproduce over state lines. We can reproduce it in multiple states and it can be the same experience. So what makes The Clear special is that a brand is not what celebrities endorsing it. A brand is not what color package it is and how shiny it is. A brand is an expectation of quality that when you take something out of a package, it's the same, right? When you open a Smirnoff, when you crack a Bud Light, when you open a Big Mac, it's the same. Now, that presents a really interesting problem in cannabis because you're growing an organic product, right? Now, because you're growing an organic product that has different relative weight to volumes of major, minor cannabinoids and terpene profiles, even genetically identical plants grown under different conditions are going to produce different results, which means that you don't have a brand if you can't essentially produce it, okay, without post-manufacturing. So how do you create a national brand in an environment where you're growing an organic product that cannot be reproduced over state lines? And that's why we went with The Clear. So The Clear can be reproduced over state lines. So when you buy our vape pen in Boston, you buy it in Vegas, you buy it in Colorado, Denver, LA, it's exactly the same. You know what you're gonna get. You know exactly what it is because objectively is the same. Subjectively, is it the best? I could make a strong argument that it is because we won all kinds of awards and things, but that's not important. What's important is that objectively, it's exactly the same. And that's kind of the position that we took, and all of our strategy from a venture side has really been structured around, okay, how do we deliver clean, reliable, consistent quality to the consumer on an ongoing basis? And that's really why we consolidated those companies. And that's why The Clear, I believe, will be one of the most prolific brands in cannabis here in the next 10 years.
That's amazing. So I was looking at your website and your dad is the CEO. Is that right?
No. So my father and I are partners. I like to say, you know, I raise the money, he spends it. But we're a very good team. We've been a very good team for a long time. So my father and I are very close. We don't have a combative relationship. We have a very collaborative relationship. And I think that's by nature of, you know, he was my coach as a kid growing up. We still own the pro hockey team in Breckenridge. So we were always together and we were always working and always trying to do something together. You know, we were always, you know, fighting a war together. And so, you know, he handles a lot of the legal, and make no mistake, the reason that we've been strategically positioned where we are is because it is the regulatory compliance and the amount of attorneys that we've had to pay to stay regulatorily compliant and deliver a consistent product to multiple states would make your head spin. And he is a magician when it comes to that, just orchestrating a symphony of attorneys to make sure that all of the piping goes the right direction, all the money flows in the way that it needs to flow so that we can continue to deliver high quality product to consumers.
Were his thoughts on cannabis when you came to him and said cannabis? I mean, he's a different generation. Was he?
Investments. He had already made a cannabis investment. Okay. So this is a true story. So I was at Merrill still. He had already made a passive investment into a cannabis company. And I had this crackpot scheme. I was like, okay, I know what we can do. I can create this fund. And because they don't have control, right, we just need a license holder at the top of the marijuana enforcement division. I think they're going to be okay with that. And I was right, obviously, 2 years later, luckily. But he was on the phone. And I'm like, if I can raise the money, will you manage the fund? And he's like, if you can raise the money. He was on the phone. But him and I have a very playful relationship. We're like, you know, we've been a team a long time. I'm very grateful for the opportunity. And there, you know, frankly, there's a lot of different circumstances that have to convalesce for an opportunity such as this to exist, right? We happen to be in Colorado, happen to have a background in finance, right? My father and I have been a good team working on different projects. My father's been a publicly traded CEO before. He has made hundreds of infomercials in the 90s. You know, he started a chain of comedy clubs called Comedy Works. You know, we've done all kinds of different businesses. And really it's about being ahead of the curve and seeing around corners, right? Like what's to come. And it was very obvious to us collectively. There was no combativeness on cannabis is going to happen, right? It was, how do we approach cannabis? And, you know, and then we worked together to create the strategy to, okay, how do we enter the cannabis market? What is going to have the most impact? Where do we think the most, you know, what's going to win the day? And it is very much our position and thesis that winning the customer and the distribution is what's going to win the day. And that's kind of how we strategy, you know, all of this has kind of culminated in into that strategy.
Amazing. Before we move on, John, any questions for Rick?
I love the arc of your story. Couple of things. One, speaking of four-wheel drive, given that I'm in Kenya right now, your great grandfather's work has transformed the continent. Some of the places that I've been able to get into the bush.
EJ would be so happy. You know, this is, you know, what's crazy is like, this is so like new. Like I didn't know, I knew he invented four-wheel drive, but I didn't have like all of this information. My grandfather, who essentially we use like an intern because he was an executive for Oracle, and now he still comes in our office with a tie on, and I run all the deals I do past him because he's Mikey, right? He doesn't like anything, right? So if he likes it, we've got something. And it was awesome. He brought in a backpack full of, and I'm not kidding you, sitting right next to me, it's like a backpack full of all of these real, you know, handwritten, typed and signed letters from PJ, who was doing this business. He also invented electroplating, which coats metals, and letters from around the world, all around the world, South Africa, in different languages. And he was doing this international business 100 years ago. And it was really kind of humbling. It was really cool. And then I looked at his signature, and his signature looked like my signature. And I was like, that's really eerie, you know? It's really cool. But I don't know. I was really humbled by the fact that, you know, we've been doing this a long time, you know, and I guess maybe it's just in my blood. We like to be ahead of the curve. But, you know, and
really, really cool. So then maybe I'd love for you to talk a little bit about this idea of the investor operator. You know, you've sat at the top, you've put the capital in. How do you think the role of the investor operator has evolved as the industry's maturing?
God, you know, it was out of necessity is really the truth. You know, originally when I left, I was like, oh, okay, we're going to make passive investments. I'll be able to look at the cannabis industry and we'll make passive investments and we're going to strategically da-da. And it became clear very quickly, because of the risk tolerance of the people that were willing to enter the space, earlier on, right? So we're talking 8 years ago, 10 years ago. They were drug dealers, essentially, right? The risk tolerance was super high, but maybe the business acumen was not where it needed to be. So the kind of business infrastructure and acumen was not there in the way that, how do we build a business that's scalable that can bring this awesome product to so many people around the world? And the answer was, well, they don't have it, right? And so we quickly realized that something that, you know, my father and I, that we do know, we really understand business and how to scale something. So we're like, okay, well, that's where we can add value. And so beyond the money, it was like, okay, well, what's the corporate governance look like? What's the capital strategy look like? What's the growth strategy look like? What's the macro strategy look like as regulations are changing? Because if there's one thing you can bet on in cannabis is that the game's going to change. It's going to change and it's going to keep changing, right? We haven't settled yet. So the key is, okay, well, it's a big wave of legalization after prohibition. You really have to be, just stay on the surfboard. You know, you don't have to get too aggressive, really. You just need to make sure that you're ahead of it and understand what's going on. So when we started looking at these businesses, we realized that they weren't doing the right things to position themselves appropriately for those changing regulations. And that's really where we decided to get more hands-on. You know, understanding that we needed to get our hands dirty so that we had a leg to stand on as we're talking to investors and we're talking to, you know, strategic partners, is that we know what we're talking about. Because, you know, frankly, I didn't smoke weed until I owned a weed company. That is true. I really, like, I was a hockey player. I wasn't a weed smoker. I was, you know, so I was like, if you're going to do something, you better know what you're talking about. And so that was really in an effort of transparency. We're just like, okay, we need to know what we're talking about. And so we got our hands dirty and operated the businesses so that we knew, you know, we knew what we were talking about when we're allocating capital. So when I look an investor in the eye and I tell them, here's the thesis, this isn't me guessing. It's like, no, I've done the work.
Well, it certainly give you an edge, that's for sure. Okay, well, moving on, Politico reported, get ready for the Northeast to become cannabis country. So while the grass often seems greener on the West Coast, the new recreational markets set to open along the East Coast have consumers and operators pretty pumped. Yeah. Rick, what do you look for in a new company entering cannabis or a new state coming online?
Okay, so it's interesting. So every state is its own little microclimate of Keynesian economics, right? Because you can't move THC over state lines, every state has its own little proclivities around, you know, supply chain economics and consumer tolerance and, you know, product mix. So you have to evaluate every state as its own little island, right? That's the first thing, right? So you go and you go, okay, what's our accessible market? Meaning how many people are using cannabis that we are aware of? How many people of those, is it medical, is it recreational, right? You need to define your accessible market. Okay. Then you need to understand, okay, how many distribution channels are there? Is delivery available or is it not available? And if it's not available, how many distribution points are there, right? This is why Canada got in trouble, is because they didn't have enough distribution channels. So we look at that and go, okay, how many dispensaries are available in the state, and how many people can they service? And then you start looking at it, okay, if they have enough distribution, do they have enough supply chain to supply that distribution? Meaning, do they have the amount of square footage that can support the amount of accessible market? And so what we're looking for is efficient markets, meaning that there's not so many licenses. This is what happened in Oregon, is that there were so many licenses issued. There was an oversupply, right, which squeezed the margins, right? There was margin compression. And then it basically put people out of business because they couldn't keep up with, you know, with the plunging prices, because they were in this little island of economics. So when we are looking at new markets, when we're entering new markets as the clear, we want to look for efficient markets, right? Because similarly, it can also be a bad situation where they're like, oh, okay, well, they've issued not enough licenses, there's not enough supply, so the price is sky high, right? So people are paying triple what we're paying in Colorado. So Colorado is really the most mature and competitive cannabis market in the world, which really gives us a good litmus test on what those other states are looking at. So as we're looking through the East Coast, right, New York, New Jersey, all of those, to paint with a broad brush and go, okay, well, the East Coast, is a mistake, right? You got to look at them individually. You got to look at really, really specifically detailed on, okay, is it a limited license environment or is it everybody gets a license? What's the distribution channels look like? Are they awarding licenses to multi-state operators and Canadian LPs? Or are they awarding licenses to local, you know, local places? Is going to define how you enter that market. So you really can't paint with a broad brush going, oh, East Coast. No, you very specifically state to state. Doesn't matter where the state is. Because of the regulatory environment as it exists today, you got to look state to state, right? And probably something important to look at would be, you know, New York giving first in line precedence to existing hemp operators who can leverage their existing infrastructure to now grow to a THC. That's a game changer, right? That changed the market, right? So you always got to look at, you know, I like to play chess and I always look at, you know, like, okay, what's the board look like? And that was a significant move in New York when now you have the opportunity of these existing hemp manufacturers to leverage existing infrastructure, right? Sunk cost. They're going to become a big player. That changed the game out there, right? So you just always, again, diligence is the most important thing. As deep as you can go, get as detailed as possible, you know, as detailed as you can stand.
Well, John, I know you've been watching kind of what's going on the East Coast in New York, New Jersey. What are your thoughts? Anything to add?
Yeah, and I completely agree with that. The regulations in these markets tend to be so variable, and the governing protocols, the ways in which these governments get their markets operational, also tend to be so varied that we're going to start to see how these regulatory policy differences manifest in how the markets perform once the doors open. New York is being quite aggressive in instituting some regulatory components that we really haven't seen done elsewhere. I mean, their approach to social equity alone is more progressive or aggressive than anything we've seen previously done. And that's partly because the activists in the state have been really, really aggressive in trying to get the state to include some countermeasures that will address the longstanding inequities in cannabis prohibition in the state. So, I mean, I would actually turn the question to Rick. I'm curious from your assessment, given the variability that we see in the way these markets are being activated. On the rec side, you've got New York, New Jersey, and Virginia. At least on the rec side, you know, which of those three do you think offers you and your brands the most compelling opportunity for aggressive growth?
New York, obviously, and partially is just because, you know, the numbers change significantly when you look at population and market accessibility, right? And that's quite simple. These are just economics. That has nothing to do with cannabis, right? This is like how many people are available to be purchasing the products because, you know, think about it like islands, right? Which island do you want to go to, right? Well, who's got the most people that I can sell to, right? It's not more complicated than that. Past that, you need to look at like what the regulatory environment looks like and what we'll tolerate and what kind of structures and how expensive those structures are going to be able to create. So New York is very interesting because there's a lot of people that have spent a lot of money, right? And I'm on record talking about CBD and how much I hate it for 4 years. You know, nobody wanted to listen to me. I was like, don't go into CBD. It's a nonsense. It's a nutraceutical. But you know, a lot of those companies had this kind of fanciful idea that they could dip their toe in the cannabis waters by entering CBD. And New York is the first opportunity where maybe I was wrong, right? Maybe they are going to have an opportunity to leverage that sunk cost. Now, I'm not sure that's going to shake out the same everywhere, but in New York, it's very interesting because there's a lot of people that have spent a lot of money getting their ass kicked trying to sell CBD as the price of CBD isolate has gone, you know, just into the crapper and beyond. So it's very interesting to see that they may have an opportunity to kind of revitalize those companies. Those are in a really interesting buying position because they've got a lot of infrastructure and they've got a lot of opportunity to leverage that infrastructure to quickly service the top end of the supply chain of cannabis in New York. So, you know, it's all about getting high quality product to people that want it, you know, and frankly, there's a huge opportunity in New York of people that have been spending money in the CBD space and the hemp space, if they are to enter the cannabis, the hemp market. So that's kind of where we're looking. But you know, we're always looking for strategic partners that are good human beings, right? Empathetic, compassionate, ambitious people. You know, it always comes down to the people. So, you know, what I would submit to you that I'm less concerned about the regulatory environment of a state and the accessible market than I am about the human beings that we're making a deal there with.
Makes sense. Well, I guess the first question would be, do you expect like all these markets coming online in on the East Coast to impact the discussions around federal reform? And if yes, how?
Sure. I think they do. So federal reform is it's just a hodgepodge.
I know we've talked it to death. I know John
I'll try to be as succinct as possible. And I'm sure if Monica was in the room, she'd be laughing at me right now. But here's the deal. The feds, there's no real lobby that has a strategic advantage to getting a ubiquitous legalization. They're already taxing the crap out of us. Right. That's the truth. Is they're already taxing the crap out of us. With 280E, the effective tax rate on plant touching companies can be anywhere north of 40-50%. Okay. So when everyone talks about like, let's tax marijuana. They're already taxing it. They're taxing it. It's happening. Right. There's no extra cash that's going to be coming to the feds by doing ubiquitous legalization. It still has to go through the state. In fact, they might be collecting less tax because guess what? 280E would go away, right? Which prohibits you from writing things like your rent and your labor against your top line revenue. So you go, okay, well, so the cannabis companies, or sorry, the feds from a federal tax perspective, they're not really incentivized to do anything on that, right? They're just going to have expense and they got to do federal oversight, right? To allow interstate trade commerce, right? Because as you know, if two state citizens sue each other, right, it automatically becomes a federal case, which means that we would need a federal program to oversee cannabis cases, right, which presents a problem when it comes to interstate trade commerce, right, which is just a big expense. So the feds are going to have to figure out how to regulate cannabis, right, which will likely get folded into, the alcohol or firearms, tobacco, like where that might go. The other component to this is that the only thing that really matters to, let's call it the macroeconomics of cannabis when it comes to federalization, is the Safe Banking Act, right? And we're not talking about checking accounts, right? I already use credit unions. We use, like, that's not important. What's important is investment banks have been watching Canaccord Genuity make so much money, right? Banking these deals, and Merrill Lynch, UBS, RBC, all the big boys, Oppenheimer, these guys have not been able to touch US cannabis. So it's the most preposterous situation where you've got US plant touching operators that Canadian investment banks are leading the way, right? You got to remember, Canada is only the same size by population as New York State, right? Canaccord Genuity by size is not even close to the size of the investment banks in the United States. So you've got all these investment banks that are on the outside looking in, that they want this done, right? They want to be able to bank cannabis, right? Because they want to raise money for cannabis. They want to be able to trade cannabis. They want to have their plant touching entities listed on NASDAQ and NYSE. So I don't believe that there's many stakeholders that are strategically incentivized to try to push federal legalization, even at the cannabis level, right? So cannabis executives, they're not really that incentivized to get ubiquitous legalization because they can go state to state and it creates high barriers to entry for other big players, right? If we got federal legalization, you got to expect Philip Morris and some of the bigger tobacco companies, bigger alcohol companies who, you know, they've already taken strategic positions in companies, are going to come in and dump a bunch of cash into the market, which I know, and whether or not they tell you or not, scares them. Right. So they're not necessarily that stoked about trying to get, you know, federal legalization. Would it make supply chain easier? Absolutely. But they're not pushing hard on Washington to get that done. Right. So there's not a lot of pressure on Congress to get, let's call, federal legalization. The only pressure on Congress to get any kind of cannabis done is safe banking by the banks, right? By the finance industry who wants to bank cannabis. And frankly, you know, I'm cheering too, right? Because it makes my life easier. because the amount of monies that we've spent on attorneys to create these very complicated infrastructures to make sure we're staying federally compliant is baffling. That's really where I see federal legalization going. It's very more likely that we'll get safe banking to go through because there is pressure. There's people that are incentivized to get that done. But from a social equity perspective and from a ubiquitous legalization perspective, there's not money behind lobby there to get that done, which is why you're seeing it stall. So I very much anticipate the feds kind of continuing to kick the can, so to speak, on, hey, states, right? Let the states do it, right? States do it. They're collecting the taxes, right? What are they just going to take on additional expense because they can do oversight? What do they care? They don't care. That's the answer. They don't care.
John, what's your take on that? I know, like I said, we've talked this through so many times.
I think there's a lot of truth to that. The given the muted response that the CAOA, Schumer's bill, got when it landed, and I think for a lot of people, it finally put into sharp relief the number of really complex issues that trying to do full-scale federal legalization would present. Just the idea of what role is FDA going to play in regulating cannabis products? Mm-hmm. One of the clauses in there was this idea that in order for a company to sell products at the state level, it first had to get approved at the federal level. So you had to almost get like this tax stamp at sort of approval. What happens if the FDA decides that it's going to stop issuing these? It's just not going to permit cannabis companies. So I think the CAOA did a couple of things. One, it made it clear that trying to get a consensus on these intractable issues, what's a good excise tax rate? What role does the FDA play? How much investment should the federal government play or channel toward building the industry and particularly addressing some of these social equity issues? Who gets released from prison? Whose records get expunged? I mean, these are all things which, if you're going to need bipartisan agreement in order to get this done, the two parties are, you know, pretty far apart, even though there's broad agreement that these issues do need to be addressed. So completely agree that one, it's the Senate is definitely a little bit chastened. I think that Schumer is probably a little bit bullish about how warmly this measure would be received. But two, I think to Rick's point, it's now put a lot more pressure on, let's at least get banking done. The idea that we are now approaching a $30-35 billion in retail sales revenue industry, you know, add 50% on that for the supply chain, and you know, you still don't have these formal banking structures. I think gets more ridiculous with each year that this goes on without it being addressed. And it's actually starting to put the US players at a competitive disadvantage in the emerging global economy. So for example, I was recently speaking to a stakeholder out of the Jamaican market, and he's like, one of the biggest problems with trying to get investment onto the island is that all of the local banks are terrified because of the history of money laundering in Jamaica. So if they receive cannabis capital, how, you know, do they get now toxic. Excluded yep. from the American, it's toxic. Yep. All of that goes away. It gives free flow, a lot of that goes away. Whether the banks will rush into this industry is a different question. But at least it creates a forum, a platform by which people who want to move money freely within the US can do that. But it also allows participation in this pretty fast.
Don, I'll go on record and tell you that the banks are going to rush into this industry. They've been standing like their face pressed to the glass looking at this, I promise. You know, I've got some buddies at Merrill Lynch, and you know, I'm telling you right now, they've been watching this ruling on the glass, like, what the, we can't touch it. And you're like, well, you know, that it's been driving them nuts. So,
and to that point, the impact that has on one, borrowing costs, you know, this has been such a private investor driven market that they've been able to set the market, they've been able to set the prices at which this money is being lent. And 100%. So the ability to introduce real competition into the capital markets brings down these insane rates that a lot of folks are paying.
Crazy rate. And people, and you know, it's interesting because most people don't even understand that. They don't know that, you know, cannabis lending rates have been north of 17% for years, right? For years, right? So you gotta imagine how difficult a market it has been to scale and grow cannabis companies, where you've got most of the capital markets won't invest, right? Or can't invest. You've got debt markets that are predatory lenders that have made it so difficult for especially taking advantage of these new bio cannabis companies that maybe don't have the business acumen. I can't tell you how many deals I've looked at where they've done just horrible structured deals that they didn't have a chance, right? Because the margins weren't there because they were paying 25%, you know, it was crazy numbers. And so that makes it really difficult for a cannabis company to scale when they don't have access to normal traditional lending instruments and financial instruments. It creates this complexity level that they're not equipped to deal with, right? And then also with the tax structure the way it is, also compresses their margins, right, significantly. So everyone's under the impression that all these cannabis companies are making all kinds of money. And I can tell you, they're not. They're absolutely not. And they are trying to survive under the way that it's structured right now. And I can tell you that probably the most undervalued cannabis asset right now, in my opinion, is private cannabis companies that have a real relationship, an emotional relationship with the consumer in the state that they are distributing in. Because A, investors can't invest in them, right? There's no way for them to invest into those companies on any kind of macro scale, right? And those companies have been struggling to have any kind of inventory financing or debt financing or any kind of financing, right? It's all been private lenders who are, you know, bending them right over a barrel going, oh, you know what? 20% because they can get it, right? So there's all these funds that have a 12% hurdle rate that they're willing to do these loans, you know, collateralized with personal guarantees. It's really horrible, right? What these cannabis companies have been trying to go through to scale. And it's going to break loose the second that the banks are allowed to, you know, and no one ever is going to say that the banks are going to be the saving grace of anybody, right? Because, you know, let's be honest, but allowing traditional financing and structure and opportunity to cannabis businesses that are operating compliantly, that's really what's going to bring, you know, cannabis to the world, so to speak, is really the opportunity for those companies to scale with reasonable margins and reasonable taxes. It's what's going to really formalize the cannabis industry. And it has less to do with interstate trade commerce, less to do with ubiquitous legalization, has everything to do with letting these companies get access to traditional financial markets and capital, and be taxed as a business, not as a, you know, some shady, you know, gray market thing. Right? Because there's some smart people that are doing this business that are working very hard that I can tell you are not being justly compensated for how hard they're working just based on the structures that have been implemented over the last 10 years.
Right. Totally agree. Well, we're almost out of time, but Rick, any other predictions or hopes for 2022?
Oh, predictions or hopes? Well, listen, I believe that cannabis is a good force on the world, which is why I feel very justified in my participation in it and my pushing cannabis in general. You know, I stopped drinking alcohol like a year ago, and you know, just seeing the impact of different, let's just call them substances, on people's lives. Cannabis is such a positive force on the cultural fabric of our society. It's intrinsic to our growth, I think, as a nation and as a world, to allow people to get access to the medicine that they need. And my hope is that the market sentiment, the regulators, Congress, and the prevailing regulations start to acknowledge that it's a positive force on the universe and on the world and on the nation to allow people access to this medicine and stop punishing people. And, you know, do what's right for the people that have been imprisoned for, you know, carrying the torch of what they knew was right. And that conviction that the people had, I can't tell you how grateful I am for the people that towed the line for so long, you know, in the face of everyone telling them they're wrong and telling them that it's illegal and that it's a drug. I can't tell you how grateful I am for the people that were like, no, it's not, that got us to where we are right now. And I think it's time that, you know, that they are justly rewarded for their conviction and courage to continue to toe that line. So that's kind of my hope, I guess, for the cannabis future, is that, you know, the truth doesn't need defense, right? The truth will eventually, you know, defend itself. And that's kind of where the stage we're at, where there's this prevailing understanding of what this actually is and the force that it has on our cultural fabric. And that's really, I think, the most important thing to me when it comes to cannabis is that that continues, that trend continues. And I think we are seeing that trend, but you know, anything I can do to help that is important to me.
Amazing. Well, we do give our guests an opportunity to give a shout out to someone in the industry that's doing something amazing or inspiring or has done something amazing. So you may give a shout out.
Well, I would give a shout out to Chris Barone. So without him, I wouldn't be sitting here. So Chris Barone invented the clear and invented distillate as a product category in 2013. It's noted in Better Buds by Ed Rosenthal when he created an entire new product category, which has allowed the clear to exist and allowed us to create a real product that is, you know, transferable and repeatable in different states, even given the regulatory restrictions. And, you know, it takes courage to create something new and try something new. And so I really respect the man, and he's still working in cannabis. He's still a part of Clear Cannabis Inc. And, you know, without him and Courtney Maltese and, you know, the people that that started that company, we wouldn't be sitting here today. So, and Chris, this one's for you, buddy.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Rick, for your time today. And thank you to our listeners for joining us at Canna Week. Again, please be sure to like, subscribe, leave a 5-star review if you love us. I am your host, Heather Wickline, and we'll see you next time.
New Frontier Data provides this podcast for entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated in this podcast should be taken as legal or financial advice. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by the company. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. Views and opinions expressed by New Frontier Data employees are those of the employees and do not necessarily reflect the view of the company or any of its officials. If you have any questions about this disclaimer, please contact our legal department.